Hello, this is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This call is going to last about 1 hour. Although we have really a lot to cover today, we might go over a little bit. I'll start with a clinical pearl, and then we'll move into questions and case studies. Just be mindful when we're talking about patients, about patient privacy. And for your reference, you're all muted, but feel free to press *7, and that's how you unmute yourself if you want to ask a question. I'll stop and pause between the sections of our call and give you an opportunity to ask questions. But if you have a burning question, you can jump in. And so let's begin. I'm going to start today with a clinical pearl that is about one of my absolutely favorite herbal formulas. And I've alluded to it before. It's called Huang Qin Tong. And we have detailed notes for most of the content of this call for everyone. You don't have to wildly take notes. And we'll also have added notes for things that occur during the call above and beyond our prepared notes. So Huang Qin Tong, it's an 1800-year-old Chinese formula. You'll sometimes see it called Scutellaria decoction, as in Scutellaria bicolensis, Huang Qin. And sometimes it's called scoot and licorice combination. So different companies have different names for it. And it's a traditional mixture of four herbs. And in the notes, I've given you the exact formula because you can find it premixed at a couple of herb companies, and I've listed those for you. But if you can't find it premixed, we just mix it in our clinic. And you can buy all the herbs and mix it according to the recipe. And it's really easy. So it's got three parts of Scutellaria bicolensis root. That's the Huang Qin. We've talked about that herb before. It's also in the course. Two parts of Chinese licorice root, Gan Sao, Glycyrrhiza urolensis. And two parts of Paeonia lactiflora, that's white peony root or Bai Xiao. And two parts of Ziziphus jujuba, red date, that's Da Zhao. And I've added a section to the notes for all of you who are Chinese medicine practitioners of the traditional use of all of those herbs and some of the Chinese ways of thinking about the herbs. For those of you who want that information, it's all part of the notes. So I just want to highlight how this formula is used. Traditionally, it has been used as a diarrhea formula. And it can be used outside the context of cancer care, but we're going to talk about it within the context. So some cancer patients, due to their disease, will have diarrhea just because they have inflammation in their gut or their pelvis from their disease, like a colorectal cancer patient or an anal cancer patient. And sometimes even there's a lot of inflammation that is due to inflammation in the female reproductive tract that spills over into irritating the colon. And so the cancer-related diarrhea, cancer treatment-related diarrhea, and radiation-induced diarrhea. Those are the things that we primarily use it for. It's a really fabulous formula. So one of the great things about it is that it will restore the intestinal epithelium and really promote regeneration. And so that's incredibly important. We talked about glutamine in another call, and we have a clinical pearl and notes on that. So if you combine glutamine with this formula, you can really restore and repair the lining of the intestines. And also, what's really amazing about this is it really protects the villi and the crypts. And that's incredible because once you lose those villi, you lose your absorptive surfaces for absorbing nutrients. So we don't want those to be damaged. It's a super anti-inflammatory formula. It downregulates TNF-alpha, NF-kappa-B, COX-2, and also inducible nitric oxide synthase. So really super anti-inflammatory, and that mostly comes from the Scutellaria. And Scuttleberry is a little bit astringent also in the same way that Golden Seal is. It's the berberine in there and those herbs that make it a little bit of astringent. So that is always helpful in a loose stool, watery diarrhea. And chemotherapy patients, 50 to 90% of them will have a loose stool and diarrhea from the enteritis that's induced by the chemotherapy. And then, of course, radiation to the abdomen and the pelvis is super inflammatory, and pretty much 70% or more of radiation patients will have radiation enteritis acutely. But there's a secondary late onset radiation enteritis that some people develop later. And so you could think of this formula in that context as well. And for not only the acute, but the rebuilding of the epithelia and the villi and the crypts. So that's really important. And so when you give this with the chemo, then you get a more rapid recovery from those acute effects of the chemo and radiation. And then that means people can continue their treatment. Remember that diarrhea is a reason that some patients have to stop their treatment because it's so extreme and it's quite painful when the colon is that inflamed. So this also helps people to be able to complete their treatment. And what's interesting about this formula also is it seems to decrease toxicity to healthy cells, but it doesn't impair the cytotoxic activity to the tumor cells, which is very interesting. And so that's good to know. There's a lot of studies, and I've given you a number of references. One of the biggest studies was done at Yale over a period of 3 years, and they call this formula PHY906. So if you want to search this on PubMed, you can use that acronym. I have no idea what it means, they gave 800 milligrams twice a day. And they, in this study, they gave it in conjunction with capecitabine or Zeloda, which is the oral form of 5-FU. And it increased survival time, improved quality of life, improved pain control, reduced diarrhea. It also improved depression. And so remember, a lot of depression is due to inflammation. So that might be why. So the conclusion of this study was that this formula potentiates the anti-tumor effect of capecitabine while mitigating the adverse effects. So we are starting to see how botanicals and nutraceuticals can be synergistic with chemotherapies and immunotherapies. Sorafenib, there was another study on that. That's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that was combined with this formula, and it also potentiated the anti-tumor activity of sorafenib, and it increased the apoptosis, and it enhanced the infiltration of macrophages into the tumors, which brings the immune system there, and it also enhances autophagy, which is another form of cell suicide along with apoptosis. So again, we see an enhancement of the drug effect and upregulation of cell death, basically, in this combination. And so I usually give this formula in terms of dosing. I usually give this formula 1 to 3 grams, 2 to 4 times a day, depending on how bad the diarrhea is. So if it's just mild, you want to mitigate the effects and keep the inflammation down in the intestines, then you could just give, 1 to 2 grams a day. And I usually have it in a tincture form or a freeze-dried granules, and the patient just dissolves it in a little warm water or ginger tea. It's best to take it with something in the stomach. It's quite bitter. You need to warn the patient about that. But it almost always works. I do want to mention one other study was done with CPA-11, which is Camptotheca, Camptothecin, and it is incredibly irritating to the intestines. It forms a metabolite, a secondary metabolite that produces severe pain, severe watery diarrhea, even sometimes bloody diarrhea. And the usual treatment is to give activated charcoal capsules to absorb that toxin. And you could give that activated charcoal with the PHY906. And so most of the studies show it doesn't interfere with chemotherapy or radiation, so you could give it concurrently and therefore preventively. So you really want to think about this in terms of also gastrointestinal cancers, liver cancers, pancreatic cancers. A lot of times there's a lot of inflammation in the intestines just with those types of cancers. And then any chemotherapy agent that is really going to cause hair loss or neuropathy will usually cause gastrointestinal distress too, because those are all reflections of affecting fast dividing cells, which the lining of the intestine is. And so we get repair and we get a diminishment of the extreme enteritis and diarrhea, and then we get an enhancement, a synergistic effect with some chemotherapy agents. And so it's really great for reducing toxicity. And so I love this formula, and I have 30 slides for you in a little slide deck that you'll get in a PDF form on the site. And I've also listed the companies I use, Suntan or Brion, B-R-I-O-N. They have this formula as Huang Qin Tong formula, and so does Eagle Herbs. They make this, and that's in freeze-dried granules. But I can't always find it, so I order my herbs either from Golden Lotus or Evergreen Herbs or Suntan or KPC. Those are the really high-quality suppliers of Chinese herbs, reliably uncontaminated and high quality. And then you could always order the single herb powders or extracts and just mix it in the proportions of the traditional formula. And sometimes when I mix it myself, I'll add a little bit of ginger in there to just kind of warm it up a little bit and warm up the digestive tract a little bit, because there's not anything like that in the formula. So I've taken a little bit of license and added that. So I'm going to take a breath here. And if you would like to ask anything about this formula or its appropriate use, I'll stop and you can hit star 7 and ask a question. Okay, so there was a question that came through. We got about 10 questions for this call, so I'm going to go through them. And one of the questions is, what are the herb suppliers that I like? So I just gave you that list. There was a question that came in about a patient who has low vitamin D long-term, and even though it's within the normal limits, it's in the low 40s, which for us, that's not our goal. We want people to be between 55 and 80. And this patient is supplementing around 5,000 units a day. And except for osteoporosis, she's pretty healthy, eating well. And so what would be the approach when we don't see the 25-OH vitamin D3 levels rising when you're dosing with 5,000 units a day? So a couple thoughts on that. Number one, you want to test 125-OH vitamin D as well as 25-OH vitamin D, because the 125 is the active form and the 25-OH is the storage form. So in some patients, they're converting over to the active form rapidly and using up the stored vitamin D. And so as long as the 125-OH is normal, you're getting adequate vitamin D activity. So you want to find that out, because if you just keep giving more oral vitamin D, you could get toxic. And you'll start to see toxicity with oral vitamin D repletion when you start to see serum calcium start to elevate in the blood. And the vitamin D is making the calcium move out of the bone compartment where it should stay. So patients who have a lot of inflammation and who have autoimmune disease tend to have this pattern of low serum vitamin D with high conversion rates to the active form. So you want to see if that's what's going on before you just increase the dose. But I also will tell you that a lot of my patients take 10,000 units a day, because cancer patients are using vitamin D at a very high rate. So it just might be that the patient really needs more vitamin D. So I recommend tracking both values in the blood. You can also try switching to a different form. If you're giving an encapsulated form that's in a powder, you might try using an emulsified liquid form and see if that's better for the patient. And then there are patients who have vitamin D receptor issues, which are genetic traits, and the absorption of nutrients to the gut can be genetic traits. So, but the prudent thing to do is track both 25-OH and 125-OH so you never overdose anyone. Next question is, on the last call, you mentioned radiation is not helpful with triple negative breast cancer. Why? So this I need to clarify because I do not feel that way. You have to look at each patient, because if you have a patient with fast dividing cells, and you can look at the pathology report to find that out, the Ki-67, and also sometimes they'll get a proliferation rate, then, or sometimes the pathologist will just say in the report, fast dividing cells, then, or the Bloom-Richardson score, you look at the pathology report to ask and answer that question. And radiation works well on fast dividing cells. So I don't remember the case, but it might have been that that patient had slow dividing cells. So I might have made the comment that, you know, we might want to question whether the risk benefit ratio for that patient for radiation was on the benefit side or the risk side. And so that's one criteria. I do not recommend radiotherapy for BRCA positive patients because, remember, the BRCA mutation is a DNA repair mutation, and we don't want to give a therapy that would damage the patient's DNA and then they couldn't be able to repair it. And that's why BRCA patients get such aggressive cancers and rapidly progressing types of cancers that can be treatment resistant. So I'm sorry for that misunderstanding. Then our next question is, you mentioned on the last call, loving feverfew. Have you ever harvested it locally and used it fresh? So feverfew is a botanical that's been used in traditional medicine for, you know, hundreds of years. And it's been used primarily for fevers, hence its common name. But in more modern botanic medicine, we've used it for migraines that are related to inflammation. And the Latin name for this botanical is Tenacetum parthenium. And this is in your notes. We use the flowers and the leaves of this plant. And we know that it inhibits prostaglandin synthesis. It'll also block platelet granule secretion, and it has some anti-tumor activity. It inhibits serotonin release and histamine release, which is one reason it's so anti-inflammatory, both through the prostaglandins as well as the histamine and mast cell inhibition. So people have allergies and certain syndromes with elevated white blood cells, like the leukemias, this is a great herb to include in the formula. And we also know that the parthenolide phytochemical in this plant, which is a sesquiterpene lactone, also will downregulate NF-kappa-B and COX-2, which are inflammatory cytokines and nuclear factors, and will inhibit cell cycling. So that means that it will inhibit mitosis and the ability of a tumor cell to replicate. And it also has pro-apoptotic activities. And remember that cancer cells lose their ability to initiate and complete apoptosis. So by turning back on apoptosis, you then have a cancer cell that will go through cell suicide, as it should, because it's an aberrant cell. So those are all the reasons I love feverfew. And I included in a lot of my formulas. So once I start showing you a lot of formulas in these case studies, you'll see that I will often put feverfew in, especially if there's a big inflammatory aspect to this patient's cancer. And then as to the question of wildcrafting your own herbs, there's a lot of things to consider with that. And there's really an art to harvesting and drying and preparing any medicinal herb. You want to make sure you know when to harvest it, when in its life cycle does it have the most amount of its active constituents and how can you preserve and optimize that. In urban environments, you have to consider whether or not the plants become contaminated. So you wouldn't want to harvest near a freeway, for example, or next to a field that's sprayed with pesticides, you know, just kind of common sense around that. And then when you use botanicals for medicinal use, you know, you really have to harvest a large volume to get a medicinal amount. You can certainly do, you know, nice mild teas with your dried herbs that you harvest yourself. But, you know, in order to get enough to have a good medicinal amount, you need a good amount to properly prepare and store. And just remember that when you have a wildcrafted or even something you grew in your herb garden and collected and dried and stored for your own use and your own family, then you never know the actual percentage of the active constituent in it. But, you know, if you grew something in organic soil properly and harvested it at the peak time and dried and stored it properly, you would have good medicine there. You just probably have a small amount. So I used to do that. I don't have time anymore. But it's an art, and you should learn how to do it if you're interested in it. Then we have another question, where do I like to get my herbal extracts? And so I told you that in the Clinical Pearl. And then additionally, you mentioned on the last call both alcohol-based, which have a very long shelf life, and glycerin extracts. So glycerin is just for kids because it tastes sweet, but it's not the best extracting agent. Alcohol-based and water-based extracts are the most common solvents for extracting phytochemicals, and you have to learn the biochemistry of the phytochemicals and what they dissolve in, and sometimes to make a good extract, we'll do a water extract and an alcohol extract and then mix them together. So that's an art also. That's really an art, harvesting herbs, preparing them properly, storing them properly, and then making medicine out of them by creating extracts, tinctures, teas, salves, etc. So that's a whole course in herbal medicine in and of itself that I don't teach, but I used to do all of that. I absolutely love it. If you love plants, you'll love doing that. Now, another question. You mentioned not wanting to do mammograms on breast cancer patients, but rather do MRIs and to reduce the amount of radiation exposure, especially with BRCA patients. But MRIs require gadolinium. What do you recommend to clear this, and how do you protect the patient? So gadolinium is a heavy metal, and so, you know, MRIs are looking at the magnetic resonance. So a metal will produce an image on the screen. And so gadolinium is really bad because in some patients, it will create a fibrosis of the nephron and permanently damage the nephron. So you have to be really careful who gets gadolinium and who doesn't, because people with kidney compromise really should not. And in practice, N-acetylcysteine used orally or IV can chelate out N-acetylcysteine. So, can chelate out gadolinium. And so those are ways to protect the patient. You could look at Walter Crinian's heavy metal detox protocols, and we can find one of his and put it up in the library. Walter Crinian is a well-known naturopath who has expertise in environmental toxins, particularly in heavy metals, and his protocols are taught and used in the naturopathic community quite a lot. But if you can do IV after gadolinium infusion related to an MRI, that's probably the most powerful thing you could do. And otherwise, you could make sure the patient takes about a gram of N-acetylcysteine a day for, you know, maybe 3 to 5 days. So that's my advice on that. Another question. Also recently, I checked tumor markers on a patient with breast cancer. I was told by her oncologist that they no longer recommend using tumor markers anymore, that it doesn't help the prognosis. What is my opinion? So I think tumor markers are very misunderstood. What is a tumor marker? It's a cell or a carbohydrate that's shed off the surface of a tumor cell. And so that's why they're CA. It either stands for cancer antigen or carbohydrate. And so you're measuring what the tumor cell is shedding, basically. And tumor markers are incredibly obtuse. They're not a fine measuring tool. So they give you kind of really general information, and they're only useful if you have a lot of tumor mass. And today they're mostly used to see if chemotherapy is working. And then once you reduce your tumor load down, they become not very useful. And it's also important to know that when you start therapy to reduce tumor mass, so you start chemotherapy, then the tumor marker could go up. And it doesn't mean the patient's getting worse. It means that there's a lot of die-off. So you also have to understand what's happening to the patient in context, where they are in their treatment cycle, and when was the blood drawn, to understand what you're looking at. So if you see tumor markers go up after treatment, that's usually an artifact of the die-off and the amount of tumor shedding into the bloodstream. So you want to take that into account. But after you don't have a lot of tumor mass, these tests don't have much value, and they're primarily used just to monitor therapy. Some other tumor markers have more value, like the CA125 in ovarian cancer, because it reflects inflammation as well. And ovarian cancers can be very diffuse, and so it's not necessarily about a tumor, but if the disease is widespread. And so we do track that, but we never treat to the tumor marker. We still want to understand our patient. And so you might see tumor marker going up, but there's no mass seen on a scan. And so again, you have to take all the data into context to try and understand what the tumor marker means. But tumor markers aren't given a huge amount of weight. They're little red flags, but they are not very precise. It's much better to monitor other factors in the tumor microenvironment as well, so that you can see if there's actually a pro-cancer physiology and terrain there. And then you have that piece of information from the tumor marker in context. So if you start to see CRP going up or interleukin 6 going up at the same time that you see hypercoagulation, at the same time you see copper and cellular plasma, and all those are raising, that means you definitely have cancer activity. But a one factor by itself usually isn't enough. So that's usually what I do, is try to have more data and more data points, so that the more times you measure the blood, then you will see trend, because you don't know if you're just looking at inflammation that was transient, or if you're actually looking at a progression. So you need more data points, and you need more biomarkers to look at a terrain rather than an isolated value that we wish was a handhold, but it really isn't. All right, then we have a few more questions. We have, can you recommend a good source, up-to-date reference guide for drug-nutrient-drug-herb interactions and contraindications, including chemotherapy, immunotherapy? Oh, don't we wish we had something like that? There absolutely are no great references. So, because there's no money to do those kind of studies, but there is some information out there. I'll tell you how to find it. There's one book, and it was published a while ago. It's by Jonathan Treasure and Dwight McKee. And it's called Herb Nutrient Drug Interactions. And it's pretty well done, but it's not up to date with more newer drugs. And there are no studies on immunotherapies and nutrient drug interactions, but I'll comment on that in a moment. So what are you going to do if there's no good reference? So the first thing you want to do is understand the mechanism of action of the drug, understand the mechanism of action and metabolism of the drug, and any nutraceuticals and botanicals you might want to use. So if you understand that, then you can get a sense of whether there might be an interaction or not. So let's think about botanicals or nutraceuticals that increase detoxification of toxins. They might also increase detoxification of a drug. So that is why we don't give liver active, detox active nutraceuticals and botanicals like N-acetylcysteine, like sulforaphanes, like milk thistle, except in certain exceptions, during the period of time when IV-infused chemotherapy agents are acting, because we don't want to disrupt that. We don't have a patient take that if they're going to have surgery, because we don't want it to inhibit the action or increase the clearance of an anesthetic or pain medication in the patient. So you have to understand how a drug and an herb and a nutraceutical are metabolized and what their mechanisms of action are. And then with that, you can often think it through. We know, for example, that cyclophosphamide is disrupted, its action is disrupted by curcumin. So you just need to know that. And so that's what I recommend. You can also actually do a PubMed search and put in curcumin drug interactions, and you can find some studies. They're mostly murine studies. There aren't a lot of human studies, but you can find references that way. And with respect to the immunotherapies and things like the tyrosine kinase inhibitors and the monoclonal antibodies, they tend to have less interactions because they're more targeted. They're more targeted to a receptor or a pathway. And so if you understand how the therapeutic agent works, its mechanism of action, then you can figure out if what you're using would interrupt that if you understand the mechanism of action of an herb or a supplement. So that is very daunting, but you have to look for the information. So the immunotherapies don't have a lot of interactions. They're very strong in their action on people for whom they're a candidate for these. And so I actually think that using some of our anti-inflammatories kind of smooths out the extreme responses that these drugs give. They're very new. The immunotherapy drugs like the PD-L1 inhibitors are new in use, and none of us have a lot of experience with them, but I've seen some very extreme inflammatory reactions that are actually damaging and dangerous. Remember that these drugs can cause autoantibody-induced hypothyroidism within 30 days of taking them, and so you want to monitor patients for thyroid dysfunction when they're on these drugs. So I think that over time, there's going to be a little more finesse using them. But right now, I think by using things like curcumin or omega-3 fatty acids or something anti-inflammatory like feverfew, it's my experience, it kind of smooths out the extreme nature, the damaging adverse effects of those drugs. So when you have a targeted drug that binds to a unique receptor, then you have like very minimal amount of interactions. And so it's really when you're doing chemotherapy that you have to worry about the most interactions. And so that's a learning curve for all of us, basically. All right. So the next question is, would you recommend the same protein dose for someone on cancer treatment as you would a survivor? I love these questions. These are great questions. So, let's just think about this in a larger context of any patient. What's the right amount of protein for any patient? So you have to look and see what's happening to them. So a surgical patient needs more protein for wound repair and resistance to infection. A patient who has cachexia or sarcopenia needs more protein because they're losing muscle mass. So you want to look at the physiology and the disease process of a patient and see if protein is indicated for them. And then protein might be contraindicated for a patient with advanced kidney disease, kidney dysfunction. So if I have a patient, and this applies a lot to older patients who naturally have a decrease in the their kidney function with age, and also patients perhaps who might have had platinum drugs, which damage the kidney and often permanently, or somebody who had their nephrons damaged by too much gadolinium exposure, as we just mentioned, then those patients need to restrict protein. And so always with those patients, I consult with their nephrologist to ask the nephrologist, what is the upper limit of protein you advise for this patient? And sometimes that would be 40 grams. And so I overall shoot for 60 grams of protein a day in my patients, but up to 80 grams a day if they have healthy kidney function and they're undergoing a big surgery or they're cachectic or sarcopenic. And those are the indications for the higher doses. You have to consider their digestive capacity and their digestive function. And do they have intestinal pathologies that would impair their ability to digest high doses of protein? Remember, when we make our therapeutic shakes, they might have 30 or 40 grams in them, but so does a meal can have that amount. So if you are concerned about the digestive capacity of your patient, like older patients have low hydrochloric acid in their stomach, which is the first step of protein digestion, and then maybe they have impaired pancreatic function or they have pancreatic cancer, maybe they aren't able to perform the exocrine function of the pancreas by producing and excreting digestive enzymes. You might have learned that on a stool test on them. And then you want to replete their digestive enzymes. I almost always give a protease with a high density protein shake because it's a liquid meal and it's going through the digestive tract very quickly. You're not chewing it, so you don't get signals to the brain that food is coming. And so you don't get quite the same normal kind of digestive response. So I want our patients to always utilize all that protein in a liquid meal. So I'll usually give something like hydralazine or even you can even give bromelain and papain and those kinds of supplements or a nice broad spectrum pancreatic enzyme kind of a formula just to enhance protein digestion. You break everything down into its amino acid form, then it can be absorbed and utilized. Remember, patients can also sip on those shakes slowly. They don't have to drink the whole thing all at once. So that's what I think about. And in patients who cannot really eat because their digestive tracts are damaged or impaired or they've just had a big surgery, there is a product by Integrative Therapeutics called Elemental Nutrients, and it's a powdered product that's high in freeform fatty acids and, amino acids and fatty acids. So you get some nutrients without requiring much digestion or breakdown. And that's for severe extreme cases or post-surgically if a patient can't eat right away. I have a patient who's going to have a big surgery and not be allowed to eat for probably 5 days due to his intestinal surgery. And also think about patients who have ostomies, ileostomies, or part of their ileum removed, and they have really impaired nutrient absorption. So you want to give something in a form that can just be absorbed right across the wall and get nutrients into them efficiently. So you know, you have therapeutic diets. So the answer to the question is, yes, most cancer patients need more protein at certain parts of their cancer journey. And these are the considerations of any person. The other kind of person who needs more protein is like somebody who's going to do a triathlon and be breaking down their muscle or do a marathon or something like that where they're breaking down their muscle and they need those amino acids to rebuild their muscle. So you have to look at an individual and see what they need. So the cancer patient in treatment has a higher need for protein than the cancer survivor, and that was part of your question. And so however, if that cancer survivor has sarcopenia or cachexia, then they need more protein. So you have to look individually. Next question is, are you familiar with a product called Master Amino Pattern? No, I'm not. Are you familiar with a product called Perfect Aminos by Dr. Minkow? No, I'm not. So this says it's a protein supplement supposed to be well absorbed with very little nitrogen waste. So that sounds good. I don't know those products, but when you're looking at amino acid products, you want to know what raw materials the manufacturer uses, because there's quite a range of quality in amino acids. Right now, Montiff, M-O-N-T-I-F-F, is a supplier of some of the most high quality amino acid products. So if that was the source the company used, you'd have more faith and confidence in that product. I am really a fan of food-based proteins, except as I just mentioned, if the person really needs to have a non-food source of protein or amino acids to use therapeutically. So you know, if a patient had trouble with protein digestion and assimilation, you could think about amino acids, but I'm much more into food-based therapies for things like that. Therefore, I'm not familiar with these products. Pardon me. You want to look at the person's diet. If they're a vegan, they might benefit from having some of the essential amino acids added supplementally or put in their shake. But I much prefer whole foods for protein. Okay. All right. So one more question. What are your thoughts on consuming sugar alcohols such as xylitol, and then there's erythritol is another one. So my feeling about that is you'll see Designs for Health and some other companies will use these as sweeteners instead of fructose or honey or agave. And that's the reason to use sugar alcohols is to use something that provides a sweet taste that does not trigger insulin. That's why they're used. And so you'll see them in a lot of diabetic products also, because it's not about insulin. However, sugar alcohols, although they don't raise insulin or trigger insulin, they disrupt the intestinal microbiome in a lot of patients, because there's a lot of organisms in the gut that use sugar alcohols as fuel, and then you get a lot of gas. So there's people, depending on their microbiome, and we don't actually know exactly how to measure who will respond with a lot of gas and bloating. But there's some people who just can't use products with the sugar alcohols because of their microbiome response. And then there's people that aren't bothered at all. So that's the end of the questions for this call. So I'll take a pause, and if anyone wants to get clarification or chime in or ask, I'll take a pause. And hit *7 if you want to talk. Okay, so let's charge ahead since we have so much to cover today. So I'm going to review a case that we did last time that we didn't finish. And I wanted to go over three cases. It's actually 6:13 right now. So I'm going to go a little bit over so I can touch upon these cases. But I've printed them all out for you in great detail. And you can, there's PDFs that will be uploaded. So the triple negative breast cancer case with the patient who also had cystitis, I didn't have all the information last month, so I want to review it. We talked about the cystitis, but we didn't talk about triple negative breast cancer. So when, with triple negative breast cancer, you want to think about things that increase differentiation, because it's a cancer that is less differentiated. It doesn't have receptors for estrogen, progesterone, or HER2-neus. That's why it's triple negative. And so vitamin A and vitamin D increase differentiation. So those are good nutrients to think about. I also like to put Honokiol into these protocols for all types of breast cancers, because it activates the PI3K mTOR pathway, which will turn back on tumor suppressor genes through that pathway. And so I always think about including that. Breast cancer patients, I like to include melatonin, 10 to 20 milligrams at bedtime, not for sleep, but because there's a lot of studies on melatonin in breast cancer. And so remember, when we build a protocol, we'll put in the foundation nutrition, right? We'll put that in to all our protocols, copper-free, iron-free multi, vitamin D, some bone minerals, some magnesium, probiotics, some fatty acids. So that's kind of the basic. And then we want to think what we want to put in that's more targeted for this patient. So something else that's pretty targeted for triple negative is green tea catechins like EDCG. So we'd want to put that into the protocol. And then I like to make a custom herbal formula for patients like this. So I have put one together, and this patient was noted to have a lot of stress. And so I made a formula that had cytotoxic botanicals and anti-inflammatory botanicals, plus something to modulate stress and promote more parasympathetic dominance. And then I always put digestive herbs into a formula. So I put in Scutellaria bicolensis and Scutellaria barbata as anti-tumor, cytotoxic, anti-inflammatory. I also put in Salvia milchariza, that's the red sage, to reduce fibrosis, also has a lot of anti-tumor and anti-coagulation activity, anti-inflammatory as well. Oldenlandia or Haedotus is one of my favorite herbs to include for its anti-cancer cytotoxic effects, but it's super anti-inflammatory. It's very high in ursolic acid, U-R-S-O-L-I-C, which is why I like to use it. There's green tea in this formula. There's feverfew in this formula. And then for kind of adaptogenic herbs, for stress adaption and resilience, I included ashwagandha and bacopa and centella asiatica, which is gotocola, as those kind of parasympathetic, stress-regulating, adaptogenic herbs. And then I add a little chen pea, which is tangerine peel, and ginger to help with digestion and warm up what is kind of a cold, bitter kind of a formula. So I have the entire treatment plan posted. And this patient also, she needed to look at body composition. She's overweight, overfat. So I would include that, improve her insulin sensitivity, make sure that inflammation is well managed. She needed her sleep cycle to be normalized as well, because she had this high cortisol and stress. So I like to teach people meditation and yoga and Tai Chi for that. And, you know, somebody's overweight, having weight loss resistance, you might want to look at their leptin signaling and their fat mass to decrease the amount of aromatase in their adipose tissue and decrease their leptin signaling. She would need to have her vitamin D status looked at. And I think a patient like this, you know, might also do well to look at her heavy metal load to see if that's impairing her immunity, optimize her copper zinc ratio, make sure she's not hypercoagulating. You could always look at genomic SNPs to see what's inefficient that you could individualize to. And at the end of these notes, I'll also put two categories. We have in this treatment plan, we have histone deacetylase inhibitors in our botanicals, which include green tea catechins like EDCG, which includes resveratrol and sulforaphanes, can always act as histone deacetylase inhibitors, which means we're keeping the DNA protected and we're keeping oncogenes turned off. So that's the function of those. And then I also have a handful of downregulators of the PI3K-mTOR pathway. This is the AKT-PI3K-mTOR pathway. It's a tyrosine kinase transduction pathway. And we can also enhance the activity of tumor suppressor genes, and some of the botanicals that do that are honokiol from magnolia, curcumin from curcuma longa, solibanin from milk thistle, withania from ashwagandha, and ursolic acid from oldenlandia. So that's just kind of a high altitude view of this, the things I'm thinking about and the things I want to include in this case. We didn't get to talk about that last time. So I'll pause for a moment if anybody wants to ask anything about that case. Okay. Remember, all the detailed notes are going to be in the library for everyone. We have a new case. It's a 52-year-old woman with multiple myeloma that she was diagnosed in 2009. And she had a bone marrow biopsy that showed her a positive diagnosis. She got 9 months of Revlimid and Velcade, which is standard of care, works very well in a lot of patients. And then she had a bone marrow transplant, so it's possible maybe she didn't get a great response. And then post-transplant, she went back on, looks like she went back on Revlimid at a lower dose. So Revlimid increases blood clotting, so we always have to include something for and monitor the blood clotting in these patients because they can have a thrombotic event. And then the patient stopped the Revlimid due to side effects, which included fatigue and neuropathy, which are common in that. Let me talk a little bit. Multiple myeloma is, you know, a hematologic cancer. It doesn't form solid tumors. It does increase the amount of proteins found in the blood, so it makes the blood more viscous, and then the treatment makes it more viscous also. So you have to really monitor hypercoagulation, have something for that. Multiple myeloma also invades the bone. Sometimes the first symptom is a bone fracture, and then the patient finds out they have multiple myeloma. Sometimes the first symptom is extreme fatigue. So in a multiple myeloma today, there's some newer thinking. You'll sometimes see patients who have multiple myeloma where it's labeled smoldering multiple myeloma, which this case is not, but smoldering is early stage. And so it's slowly changing the bone marrow and the cell profile. And so the thinking was you wouldn't treat patients at smoldering multiple myeloma, you'd wait. But the standard of care is to start with Revlimid and dexamethasone. And a lot of oncologists now and studies show that if patients start on those early on, they have less progression. So then our job is to make sure they have less progression as well by putting our toolbox in. Also, you should know that if a patient is on Velcade, they cannot use any supplements with boron and they can't use green tea because there is a drug interaction for you. So multiple myeloma is very inflammatory. So we want to make sure we have good inflammation control, a good hypercoagulation control, because it invades the bone. We support bone health. And so we also can target the inflammatory cytokines and pathways like TNF-alpha and FKB and all the inflammatory cytokines. And then also this AKT, PI3K, mTOR pathway should be targeted. And there are active agents that we know work well in multiple myeloma, the sulforaphanes, for example, and particularly the glucorafenin. So that's always included. A low dose of DHEA has proven helpful in multiple myeloma, 5 to 25 milligrams in the daytime. Monitor the blood levels. Licorice root extract also for its steroid-like effect to control the inflammation. Sometimes patients can take less dexamethasone, which is a steroid, but controlling inflammation is huge. Ursolic acid has been shown to be active in multiple myeloma patients. So we mentioned the Oldenlandia and also sage and rosemary are high in ursolic acid. And it's also found in a lot of foods like basil, apples, prunes, cranberries, they have a little bit of ursolic acid in them. But they're all, ursolic acid acts as a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And so it can stop the unfolding of a pathway that leads to proliferation and disease activity. Also, Hinokiol is fabulous. Pure Hinokiol made by Clinical Synergy, 3 caps, 3 times a day. That's a high dose. Alphenol will give the last dose at bedtime because it's sedative. Some people get sleepy in the daytime, so then I tell them to take the Hinokiol at dinner and bedtime. Optimize her vitamin D. You can use something like Ganoderma as a if you want to use an immune tonic type mushroom because it's super anti-inflammatory. The Chinese herb isatis root, banlanggen, also is very active in multiple myeloma, and curcumin can be used. So those are active for multiple myeloma. In terms of the hypercoagulation, I generally will use the omega-3s, the curcumin, the Donshen, salvia, milchiorhiza, and proteolytic enzymes like proline or wovenzyme or something like that. And then in all cancers where you really want to put the brakes on progression, I really like to use modified citrus pectin, about 5 grams, 2 or 3 times a day. That has to be dissolved in hot water and then taken either 15 minutes before or an hour after herbs, supplements, or foods, because it'll bind to the nutrients otherwise. And then again, to protect the bones, think about a good bone mineral product. I like OsteoBend by Designs for Health a lot, 2 twice a day. And also I have a formula that I compound for my patients in my clinic that is made with Restore the Right formula Romania 8. And I add Soralia and Epimedium and White Pinene. All of those have been studied and have good research to show that they actually promote bone repair and restore bone density. And then I always put an adaptogen in for someone who's going to have a long marathon with their cancer. And so I like Natura Health Power Adapt formula quite a lot. You might want to take a look at that. And then I suggest a custom tonic also. And I've put the formula into the notes for all of you. And it follows these principles. You know, I've put herbs in that all these functions that I want to have. And you have to also really monitor kidney function, because there are these big light chain molecules that end up in the blood that the kidney has to filter, and it can damage kidney function. And in multiple myeloma patients, I restrict resveratrol because it's been shown that patients with high titers of light chains don't do well with resveratrol with respect to kidney damage. So there's some contraindications, you know, that we look at. So those are kind of the big high altitude ideas for multiple myeloma, which is a chronic disease. So I do have one patient that achieved complete remission without a stem cell transplant, a bone marrow transplant. And his oncologist, his hematologist, told me he's never had a patient who had the results that look like someone had a bone marrow transplant, but they didn't. So there's a long tradition in modern Chinese medicine with herbal medicine and multiple myeloma. And so it's a very manageable chronic illness, but it does progress if you don't manage it. And you know, I would consider maybe thinking about a low dose of Revlimid, or 1 week on, 1 week off, something like that, if you had to stop because of the side effects, because it just, it's hard to argue against the control it gives multiple myeloma patients. So, you know, that's up for discussion and evaluation. So it is actually, let's see what time it is. It's actually 6:28. So I have an ovarian cancer case that I'll also just do quickly, and then you can read the detailed notes in my treatment plan on your own, because we are getting a lot of case studies, and I want to expose you to different kinds of cancers. So let me go through this case quickly. So this is a case of ovarian cancer recurrence, and ovarian cancer recurs a lot, and this was actually identified by following the CA125 tumor marker. And in ovarian cancer, we do look at the tumor marker. It is useful, but don't give it too much weight, because a person can still have high CA125 and not have aggressive disease. So, but this patient, her CA125 was increasing. She's a little complicated because she has an ileostomy and a nephrostomy. She's only got one kidney, and she doesn't have good nutrition absorption, and she also had a cholecystectomy. So, she, you know, her nutrient digestion and absorption is probably impaired. She had a mother with breast cancer, but her mom got breast cancer at 82. So that's kind of the high altitude view. She did work with a naturopathic doctor, got IV vitamin C, but discontinued it in 2016. And so that might be something to reconsider. She had chemotherapy in 2016. She had a complete hysterectomy. And with omentum removal and tumor debulking, that's standard of care. She did require paracentesis, which means she had a lot of fluid in her abdomen. So she was probably had a high tumor burden and was very inflamed. So right now we don't know, we don't have any labs on her, and we don't really know what the plan of her oncologist is. But let me tell you how I would think about this from a high altitude view. So, you know, definitely ovarian cancer, it recurs, and it our job is to try and lengthen the time to recurrence because it's pretty treatment resistant and a very aggressive and kind of heterogeneous kind of a cancer. So, you know, a treatment will get some of the cells, but not all of the cells. Some of these patients are BRCA positive, and in that case, they can do PARP inhibitors, which work pretty well. There are some immunotherapies coming up for ovarian cancer patients, so I would push the oncologist to look at more leading-edge therapies. I happen to know this patient's in Canada, so there might not be in a national health system. Early adopters of new ideas are very expensive treatments, but you know, can push the oncologist to explore more targeted treatments when you have a recurrence of any kind, because a recurrence means you had resistant tumor cells. And so you can't just repeat what you did before, because the cells that survived are the resistant cells. So I'm going to think about that. A patient like this should definitely optimize their vitamin D. You want to make sure they have, you know, as much nutrient density and support for their nutrition as possible. In terms of having only one kidney, if it's a healthy kidney, you can live quite well with one healthy kidney. So unless there's a problem with a kidney, we don't have to be super concerned about that. Unless she was to do a nephrotoxic therapy, then we might want to negotiate with the oncologist to protect her one remaining kidney and think of things that aren't super nephrotoxic for her. We want to think about something cytotoxic, something that reduces disease progression. So I like to use artemisinin. So Allergy Research makes a super artemisinin. Natura Health Products makes an artemisia product. And so I like to get up to about a gram or two a day of artemisia. And I use it every other week because tumor cells do become resistant to it. But it's very cytotoxic. Tumor cells will sequester iron, and artemisinin binds to iron, so it'll go into the cancer cell where the iron is and bind to it and create an oxidative event and damage the tumor cell and cause cell death. So I like to use artemisinin when we have aggressive cancers, but you have to take a break from them. There's a couple of other things that are really active against ovarian cancer that should be considered as part of a treatment plan. So ginkgo biloba has some studies on ovarian cancer, about 2 grams a day. Fermented wheat germ has studies. And there's a capsulated form of it now called metatrol. And I'll give a cap twice a day inside of a treatment plan. Stops progression. Selenium is important in these patients. So you're going to track selenium. You never want to replete selenium above 400 micrograms a day. You can get about 200 micrograms a day by eating 2 Brazil nuts every day. So that relieves people of a pill. You want to use the methionine, the methyl form of selenium when you supplement. One of my favorite herbs, Huang Qin, Scutellaria bicalensis. I'll give up to 3 grams a day in a program for an ovarian cancer patient. The Honokiol is very good, as we just discussed in the prior case. 2 caps 3 times a day, last dose at bedtime. I also like to use combination powders of medicinal mushrooms. Clinical Synergy makes a nice one called Mushroom Immune Max. Natura Health Products makes 2 different products. The InnuCare 2 product is has the highest amount of mushrooms in it. So, and it comes in a powder also. Both of these come in capsules and powders. And mushrooms don't taste like much, so I often put them in the shake. So about 3 or 4 grams a day for mushroom powders. In a progressive cancer, always give the patient modified citrus pectin, 5 grams, 2 or 3 dimes a day. I would include EGCG, the green tea catechin, about 2 grams a day, and about 2 to 4 grams a day of curcumin. So those are things to think about putting into a protocol. I definitely check copper levels in a patient who's progressing. Would definitely look at hypercoagulation because ovarian cancer patients have a lot of fibrosis in their pelvis. And so if you see that they have high D-dimer and high fibrinogen activity, then I add, by itself, I add extract of Dunshan, salvia, milky oryza, the red sage. I'll give them a teaspoon 2 or 3 times a day, and that just decreases the fibrosis and also exposes, by doing so, exposes the tumor cells, cell membrane, and receptors to the immune system and to botanicals or conventional treatments. Also, these patients can get really weary and very tired. It's also a long haul going through ovarian cancer recurrences. And this patient's had a lot of health issues. So there's a traditional Chinese formula called Sichuan Da Butong, or all-inclusive tonifying formula, or it's sometimes called the 10 Great Tonification Formula. And I would give 2 teaspoons a day or about 3 to 6 grams a day of a powdered form, because this formula is a super tonifying formula for, regular physiologic function, energy production, mitochondria, building blood, building qi, as we say in Chinese medicine. But it also has been used historically for hundreds of years in cancer patients. And it is not toxic. So I would put that into a very depleted patient. And then if you want to do something really aggressive with a patient like this, which is warranted in ovarian cancer recurrences, super low glycemic diet, intermittent fasting, ketogenic diet for 24 to 48 hours before they get a cytotoxic therapy like chemo, or before they got a cytotoxic naturopathic IV infusion. So I would consider maybe IV vitamin C, IV artesunate as cytotoxic therapies, IV mistletoe as an immunotherapy. Think about oral copper chelation with this patient. She could take low-dose naltrexone, 4.5 milligrams at bedtime. These are all prescription items. You need a naturopath or a physician to work with. And also, I've seen very good results with ovarian cancer with cannabinoids from marijuana, cannabis, THC to CBD in a 4-to-1 ratio. So I've seen that help treatment-resistant patients with ovarian cancer. You know, make sure her body composition is good, more muscle mass than fat mass. This patient's overweight. And then, you know, do a good assessment of her biomarkers in her tumor terrain to see if there's anything else we need to highly individualize or optimize. So that's kind of a zoom through an ovarian cancer case. I'll, at 6:38, we're 8 minutes over. I'll stop for questions if anybody has them. No questions today. Okay. So you're either all on overload or you want to go read all the notes. So I guess we will close then, and we've reached over the end of our time today. I want to thank you for your attention and your participation and for submitting such great questions and cases. Remember, you can submit your questions and cases in advance, but please, if you give me 2 weeks advance notice, you can be more certain that your case and your questions will be on the next Grand Rounds call. Otherwise, we catalog them and choose cases and questions that are most relevant to all of our students. Our next call is on the schedule for November, and let us know if you need any extra support. as you go through the course. And if there's anything you'd like to see covered in a clinical pearl, you can also ask us for your wish list. Was requested to discuss copper chelation, so I'm planning to do that in the next call. Thank you, everyone, and good night.